As part of our occasional backstory series, we will be checking in over the next few months on how the former communist states of Eastern Europe are doing, and our first installment takes a look at Ukraine. It's been 20 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union and over 5 years since the excitement of the Orange Revolution. But interestingly, its two champions, Viktor Yushchenko and Yulia Tymoshenko, lost their posts in this year's Ukrainian elections. Joining us now is Timothy Snyder, a professor of history at Yale University, who wrote an article on Ukraine for the most recent edition of the New York Review of Books. I'm very pleased it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Very glad to be here.
You write that Ukrainian politics is full of the courageous and the grotesque, and it is no easy task to tell the difference. Have the political and economic transitions in Ukraine over the past two decades been particularly difficult for the country?
It's been extraordinarily difficult. Ukraine had to do four things. It had to build a state, an independent state, which wasn't true for some of the East European countries. It had to go through the transition to a free market economy, which is still very difficult. It had to create a government of its own, new institutions, and then also it had to try to defend something like a civil society. All of those four things at once is a pretty tall order for any country, and Ukraine is a big, complicated, multicultural, multi-religious bruiser in the middle of a difficult part of the world.
So it's unlike Hungary or Poland, which were already nations. But didn't the Balkans have to go through similar transitions? How come it's worked out better for them?
You mean the Baltic states?
Baltics, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Lithuania, I do that all the time myself, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia.
Greece is having its own problems right now.
Yeah, I mean, if Greece were a post-communist country, everybody would know how to talk about it. Those are much smaller countries. Those are countries with very small populations, which were brought into the Soviet Union somewhat later and didn't go through some of the most terrible parts of Soviet history, which included mass starvation and mass terror. Also, because those were small countries and geographically close to Scandinavia, they always had a shot at the European Union. And it's one thing to be in, which they are, but also it matters if you have a chance, because if you have a chance, then you always have a really good argument for reform. The argument is if we reform in the right ways, then they'll let us in, and then we'll have access to investment, and we can move around and become much more prosperous.
Well, how many Western market reforms did Ukraine embrace in the years following the communist era?
Well, it's a market economy, but now you're on to the two key issues. The first is, what kind of market economy is it? It's a market economy a bit like Russia's, in which a rather small number of people manage to get hold of the important assets. Those are the people both in Russia and Ukraine who are called oligarchs. And then the second problem, which is related, is that despite what the libertarians say, you can't have a functioning market economy without a strong state, without law, without the rule of law, without police that aren't corrupt to enforce that law. And in Ukraine, the biggest problem is with the rule of law.
Well, many economists have argued for the past few decades that the introduction of free market principles will lead to democratic reforms. Has that played out in Ukraine?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I think that on its own is a pretty bad argument. Ukraine, interestingly enough, has managed to be the one important, that is, large post-Soviet state that is a democracy, despite the fact that the free market has been a complete shambles over there. Not only is it not very well defined, as I say, it hasn't led to anything like prosperity. Last year, the economy in Ukraine went down by 15%. If one imagines what that would mean in the United States, I mean, it would really be quite something. But nevertheless, 69% of the population went to vote.
Has that decline been the result to some degree of the global economic downturn?
Yeah. Post-communist countries like Ukraine and Russia were disproportionately vulnerable to the global economic downturn. Yeah.
And why them more than other countries? I mean, 15% is a real decline.
They're overly dependent upon a few sectors which themselves are oversensitive, like chemicals and steel. Also, the richest people in Ukraine were taking risks with their money, which they shouldn't have, and they represent a disproportionate part of the economy. The richest people in Ukraine's fortunes went down by something like, often like a function of 80%. So people who were, you know, in the top 50 in the Forbes count are now in the top 500.
Is that to some degree the responsibility of Yushchenko and Tymoshenko, or did they have no real control over that?
That's a great question, because that's exactly where things went wrong with the two of them. They are the two who, as you recall at the top of the show, came to power during the Orange Revolution in 2004-2005. As a result of the confirmation of democracy, he was president and she was prime minister. And the thing that they both failed to do, despite the fact that they both promised to, was to bring something like the enforcement of normal market capitalism to Ukraine, something where the rule of law was predictable. What happened instead was that Yushchenko discredited himself in a few small scandals, and Tymoshenko maintained her reputation as someone who would go after the big boys, but she and Yushchenko fell out very quickly, and her first government fell. So in a way, that's exactly where things went wrong.
You call Yulia Tymoshenko the only real man in Ukrainian politics.
Well, that's how she presents herself.
Despite the braided hair.
Yeah, I mean she has it both ways. I mean, a lot of very intelligent female politicians do this, but I think she may be the very best. On the one hand, she's tough and she's smart and she's much faster on her feet than any of the other politicians in Ukraine. On the other hand, she's beautiful and she's charming and she can get lots of people, including Western economists, to believe what she says. And as a result of that, she has a kind of 1-2 punch, which leaves most of her opponents vulnerable. And I think if the economy hadn't crashed by 15% last year, she probably would have won the election.
Well, what happened before the Orange Revolution? The post-Soviet era, the country was first headed by Leonid Kravchuk and then Leonid Kuchma. I'm very pleased. Two Leonards ran the country. What kinds of relations did they have with the West and with Russia? And why aren't they being held responsible for not instituting more of the reforms that were necessary to make this country succeed?
Well, there are a couple of things which are worth recalling here. The first is that just making Ukraine an independent state was something extraordinary. It had been tried half a dozen times in the past, but it had never succeeded. And so the fact that people voted in a referendum for Ukraine independence and that it actually happened, and it happened peacefully in December of 91, which was something which gave Kravchuk a kind of credibility for a while. Another thing to be recalled about Ukraine in those early years is that Ukraine did something which was very intelligent and generous, which we now have completely forgotten. It's another thing we've forgotten, which is that it gave up its nuclear weapons, basically for a pittance. So at a time when we're concerned about new countries going nuclear, Ukraine is an example of how it can actually go the other way. Now, that was an example of the balanced foreign policy which Kravchuk and then also Kuchma pursued. On the one hand, they tried to maintain good relations with Russia. On the other hand, they tested the waters to see how close they could get to American institutions and to North Atlantic institutions and to European institutions. And I think that's what we can expect from Yanukovych, by the way, as well. He's portrayed as being pro-Russian, and in some respects he is, but there's only so much he can get out of Russia. And after a while, or rather soon probably, he'll be testing the waters to see what Ukraine can get out of Western institutions.
My guess is Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale. We're talking about post-Soviet Ukraine as part of a backstory series. Well, the presidential race between Yulia Tymoshenko and Mr. Yanukovych was incredibly tight, and she challenged the results. But is that weird? Because she said that there was tinkering with the results, even though he had no real power at that point, did he?
Yeah.
How can he steal an election when he doesn't really when he's out of office?
Yeah, I mean it's a good question, and the answer is that he didn't. I mean the observers who were there didn't find anything, and then there are also some really smart political scientists who have some ways of going over the results, and no one can find anything which was seriously wrong. There was a little bit of fraud here and there, but nothing which would have swayed the elections. But it's not surprising that she did that. I mean, first of all, she's completely ruthless herself in what she will say about other people. Secondly, Yanukovych did try to steal one election, very obviously, the last time around, and she wants people to remember that for the future. And the third thing is, I think she wanted to remind people, as you say, of just how close the election actually was.
Well, the election that he tried to steal in 2004, he had the strong support of Vladimir Putin, But you say that that can only go so far this time?
Something really interesting has happened there, which is that Russia has swung ahead of us, broadly speaking, in terms of how well they understand Ukraine. Last time around in 2004-2005, the European Union and some of the Americans and the Poles had a certain edge because they understood that Ukrainian politics wasn't just about ethnic Russians and ethnic Ukrainians in East and West, and that the democratic revolution, which was going on, had something to do with the civic identity and the desire to have votes counted. The Russians saw it in ethnic terms back then. Putin saw it as a kind of minority, Ukrainian nationalist minority, which was working against Ukraine's natural interest in some kind of closer union with Russia. They learned their lesson in the meantime. Putin is a very smart man, and he has realized that Ukrainian politics are not just about Ukrainians and Russians, and that Yanukovych, although he comes from the Russian-speaking East, is not necessarily going to be an obvious ally of Russia. In fact, it's gone further than that. There's a sign of real cooling between Putin and Yanukovych. Russian newspapers write very critically about Yanukovych, and I think there's no particular reason to expect that that's going to be a political friendship.
Well, on the other hand, Ms. Tymoshenko won most of the west of Ukraine, Mr. Yanukovych most of the southeast, the part closer to Russia. She campaigned speaking Ukrainian. He campaigned speaking mostly Russian. So there is still that pro and anti-Russian divide here, isn't there?
It's as terribly interesting and complicated as American politics and, you know, in our red states and our blue states. She spoke Ukrainian, and she speaks a beautiful Ukrainian, but she learned it in her 30s. She's as much an Easterner as he is. And
how different is Ukrainian from Russian?
It's like French and Italian, say, mm-hmm. or, you know, you certainly have an advantage, but you have to go to some trouble. And also, in order to sound good speaking Ukrainian, you have to speak it very well, because it's very easy to make mistakes from Russian in Ukrainian.
Mr. Yanukovych received help from American political consultants, Paul Manafort, who worked for, if I'm correct, Presidents Ford, Reagan, and both Bushes. I mean, here we have Yanukovych, who's most closely linked to the old communist regime, going to a Republican consultant.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I mean, I don't particularly find it surprising, because both because of, you know, because Yanukovych is, I mean, Yanukovych is in some sense a conservative, or at least that's the pessimistic interpretation.
Well, is there any nostalgia for the old communist system? In some of the other Eastern European countries, young people are reported to have some sense of nostalgia for the communist era, even though they didn't experience it.
Yeah, well, I think not experiencing it is a big edge if you want to be nostalgic for it. But Yanukovych is more interesting because he is in some sense of a new generation. He's a post-communist politician in the sense that he looks and moves, and he has the hair of a communist. He dresses like a communist. He has the paunch of a communist. But he was not from the old nomenklatura. He was a small-time thief. He was involved in little gangs. He worked his way up in the transport sector. In some sense, he's somebody who made it on his own. And that's actually kind of a way that he has a sort of Republican appeal. He's someone who's from the common people, but nevertheless became extraordinarily rich.
Last year, the International Monetary Fund refused to release a $16.4 billion rescue loan to Ukraine because of the country's fiscal policies. It was reported yesterday that Mr. Yanukovych's government is hoping to revive cooperation with the IMF. Would that large of an infusion of cash help jumpstart the economy?
Ukraine is, for several years now, Ukraine has basically required IMF loans just to meet operating costs, not only year to year, but month to month. I don't think that will revive the economy. It's more like a life support system, which both sides realize is necessary. The IMF has been rather generous and tolerant with Ukraine, and Ukraine has found reasons, especially under Tymoshenko, who was extraordinarily clever with this, for the IMF to make exceptions.
What about corruption? According to Transparency International, Ukraine is one of the most corrupt countries in the world, tying with Ecuador, Zimbabwe, and Russia.
Yep, for 146th place. I really like that Ukraine and Russia are tied for the same place. Corruption is absolutely the central issue, and Yanukovych knows that it's the central issue. And if there's anything like an emerging consensus about what has to happen in Ukraine, it has to do with corruption. Yanukovych knows it because he profited from it, and he knows the other people who profited from it. And there's a question as to whether these people who have become extraordinarily rich will now, as a certain kind of optimistic, you know, liberal theory has it, will now want to institute the rule of law so that their children and grandchildren and so on can live in a safer environment. There's also a perception and awareness of this now on the side of the EU and on the side of the United States, that it's not about democracy anymore. It's really about the rule of law and the ability of small and medium-sized businesses to function. That's what's missing in Ukraine now. It's not democracy, interestingly enough. It's a democratic country. It's an impressively democratic country. What's missing is precisely the ability to function normally in an economy.
But you're saying that Yanukovych has ties to many of the powerful oligarchs in Ukraine, and that actually gives him some leverage. The Orange Revolution leaders didn't have those connections?
Well, as people said at the time, it was the millionaires against the billionaires in the Orange Revolution. Tymoshenko is herself a kind of oligarch. She is quite wealthy. No one quite knows on what scale. The Orange Revolutionaries were generally, they represented the majority of the population at the time, and then plus people who had made millions of dollars, let's say. The big oligarchs in the southeast, where there's steel, those people were on the side of the Party of Regions, which is to say Yanukovych, yeah.
It's being reported today that Mr. Yanukovych's government is now looking to sell Ukraine's state-owned natural gas pipelines to a consortium that includes Russia's gas giant Gazprom and an unspecified European country as a way to lower gas prices. Here we have a form of communist privatizing?
That's in a way the secret to the last 20 years is just who and how who privatizes what to whom. Let's say, how transparent the processes are. These things are absolutely crucial. It's important that Westerners are allowed to bid and that Westerners are allowed to cooperate. One of the things which goes wrong in transitions is that communists privatize, but they privatize to their buddies, which means that valuable assets end up in the hands of people who don't really know how to manage them, who take huge profits from them. And as a result of that, people lose faith in the market and they lose faith in the transition. That's been a huge problem in Russia, and it's a problem in Ukraine as well.
Today's New York Times described the Ukraine-Russian pipeline deal as a coup in Russia's long-running quest for supremacy of the Russian pipeline network, sometimes called a modern version of the Great Game after the 19th century struggle between Russia and Britain for colonial possession in Central Asia.
Yeah,
what do you make of that analysis?
Ukraine, I mean, in the Great Game, it's Afghanistan. There's nothing there, but it's on the way to everything. Ukraine is the Afghanistan of the 21st century. There aren't any resources there to speak of, but it's on the way to everywhere. The pipelines run through it. It's in a crucial spot. One would like to think that geopolitics are over, but so long as Europe is dependent upon Russian energy supplies, we are still, unfortunately, in a geopolitical world.
Do you see Ukraine as ever being integrated into the EU?
I think that it's a prospect. I think that it's a distant one, precisely because the things that are at the heart of what the EU needs to see are administrative capacity and the ability to enforce the rule of law, which is where Ukraine is weakest. However, I think that it is a possibility. I think it's something that we might see in our lifetimes. In order for it to work, Ukraine has to have a lot of good fortune, but also the EU needs to find a way to lay out little steps along the way after which it can reward Ukraine in ways that are short of full membership. It's a stalemate now because obviously Ukraine is a long way from full membership. And the EU doesn't have much of a foreign policy. It doesn't really have a way to move people step by step towards membership.
Thank you so much for talking with us. Timothy Snyder is a professor of history at Yale University. He wrote an article on Ukraine for the most recent edition of the New York Review of Books. It's been fascinating. And thank you so much for participating in this backstory segment.
Very glad to do it. Thanks.